Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Timothy Garrett King. It's currently 9:19 a.m. on Tuesday, October 25th, 2022. I'm here today with the director of the Texas Prison Museum in Huntsville, David Stacks. I'm conducting this interview to gain a deeper understanding of the history of Huntsville's prison system, the Walls Unit in particular. I'll be asking you questions in pursuit of that goal. This research is for a project in my Honors College seminar. I'll be recording the interview on my phone, and the recording may be shared with my class. The questions consist of a mix of factual concepts along with some personal opinions on the topics. Given your time at the museum, your extensive knowledge of the prison's history, I believe that both types of questions will provide meaningful feedback. Before we start, do you have any questions or concerns that you'd like to address?
I do not, but I look forward to the interview. Thank you.
All right, let's begin. Okay, so to start things off, can you give me a brief overview of the history of the Walls Unit?
Well, the Walls Unit, which is the informal name of the official name, is the Huntsville Unit. The Huntsville Unit came about as a result of a commission that was put together in 1848 to locate a geographical area in the state of Texas where the state could build and establish their first prison. As a result of that commission, Huntsville, Texas was identified as the best geographical location to be the site for this prison. From what I've been able to research, it had three areas of need. One was a large body of water, which the Trinity River satisfied. A lot of wooded areas, because that was their primary source of fuel back at that time. And then, of course, just the general climate of the Huntsville area seemed to be a proper climate to establish a prison system. I think the big ace in the hole, though, that no one really talks about is the fact that General Sam Houston was still very much alive and well back then, and he still had a lot of political clout. And I believe, I don't have any facts to support this, but I believe that probably was one of the feathers in the cap for Huntsville to get to prison. The prison was actually started construction that same year in 1848. And in about 1849, if I remember correctly, is when they received their first prisoner. He was a horse thief out of Fayette County, and named Samson, I believe, was his name.
Yeah, I don't doubt that either, because it's like, you know, government decisions usually take quite a while. So in terms of the actual structure of the Huntsville unit, the Walls Unit, I know that the Walls Unit was built in 1849, but how many times has the prison been, like, renovated since then?
Well, I think let's talk about just the facade itself. The original structure of that building was made out of sandstone brick. Mm-hmm. What they determined early on, I guess you might say, or I should say years later, is that that was not a very good material to make a prison. Out of one, it didn't weather well with the elements, mm-hmm. As well as it was being a friable type of material. It was escape prone, people digging through it and things of that nature. But the facade itself that I'm aware of has gone through three changes. The original was a kind of a flat, walled entrance. Then there was more of a Gothic style structure made out of sandstone as well. And then once that was determined to be inefficient, they went with the current facade that you see now at the walls, which is a red brick structure. And in fact, the entire sand brick prison, because of its deterioration, was encamped or surrounded or encased, whichever word you like to use, with red brick, hard-fired red brick, and that's what the structure that you see today. What a lot of people don't know is that sandstone is inside that brick wall.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask about the red bricks, because I've seen the red bricks for years. I didn't know if there was a specific brick that was just special for the prison.
Well, the prison system had their own brick plant. Mm-hmm. They had their own brick plant down at Jester, or I should say Harlem, what it was back in the early days, the Harlem unit. And they made all of their red brick. It was hard-fired, killed brick, and that's what the majority of our prisons that were built from the 30s on with hard-fired red brick, and they came out of the Jester plant.
That's pretty ironic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that the prison's construction impacted the development of Huntsville?
Well, I think if I'm interpreting your question properly, I would say it was just a huge impact, economical impact, mm-hmm. for the city of Huntsville, and it still holds true today. You know, back in those days, they didn't pay a guard but maybe $50 a month, which was hardly anything. However, some of those officers and employees were given some subsidy-type things like vegetables and emoluments, things of that nature to help supplement their livelihood and quality of life. But I think the biggest impact the prison system has had on the city of Huntsville is strictly that. It was a huge economical impact for the good for Huntsville. And then, of course, Sam Houston State, likewise. I know your question didn't ask about that, but Sam Houston State University is a major economical benefit to the city of Huntsville as well.
Mm-hmm. If you're familiar, who are some of the notable criminals who have been held in the Huntsville prison system?
Well, I think probably the one that comes to mind back in the, let's say, cowboy western days would be John Wesley Hardin. He was a gunfighter, and he was convicted and sentenced to the Walls unit and spent many, many years there at the Huntsville unit. In fact, he was such a gangster when they first got him. Stories I've read is that they created a solid steel cell inside the cell block that they put him in, and he stayed there for many years because he was such a notorious criminal and caused so many problems. But he finally surrendered that type of behavior and became more amenable to following the rules of the institution and worked his way into a regular job. And as history tells you, he became a lawyer and practiced law upon his release. I guess another one would be more recent that I can think of would be a guy named James White. James White was a guy that was sentenced for executing a few college co-eds down at the University of Texas in the 60s. He did a significant amount of time in prison, starting out at the Walls and went to various other prisons. Because I think most anybody of any notoriety came through the Huntsville unit prior to the 1960s, because there was no designated diagnostic center where people were brought in and processed. They were all processed there at the Huntsville unit. Another one, I hate to even use the word fame with it, but notoriety, I guess, would be Fred Carrasco, because of the significant incident that he created in the early 70s and 74. Mm-hmm. Those are just a few that I can think of.
I came across something that said that it held federal prisoners of war during the Civil War.
That is true. Back during the Confederacy and the Union War, the Civil War, I don't remember the name of the boat, the Union boat, but there was a Union boat down in the Galveston Bay that was taken by the Confederacy, and most of those Union soldiers were brought to the Huntsville unit and deposited there for the remainder of the war. Many of those were black naval officers, mm-hmm. or I should say Navy soldiers, as mm-hmm. well as white. Those individuals were sentenced to perform work in the mechanical shops or other industries, textile mills that were there at the Walls to help the families of the Confederate soldiers who were off at war, to help the mothers and the children clothe them and feed them and things of that nature with shoes and clothes to help them get through the hard times of the Civil War. So, yes, that is an accurate statement. There were POWs from the Union kept there. And what's somewhat interesting is that Sam Houston, who I mentioned earlier, he frequented the Huntsville unit to check on the Union soldiers to make sure that they were being treated properly. I think a lot of that had to do with his, the nobility of him being a statesman as he was and a military officer himself. He knew the importance of making sure that the prisoners of the Unions were being treated properly.
Yeah. Okay, so everyone in Huntsville is familiar with the bats near the walls unit.
Mm-hmm.
What could you tell me about them, and how long has that whole deal been going on?
Well, I'm not an expert in bats in any way, but we had where the bats have now habitated in that building right to the west of the Huntsville unit west wall. That was at one time a warehouse that the prison used to store raw materials, primarily cotton. And cotton was then taken over to the textile mill inside of the walls, and that's where they would create their string and then create their cloth, and then from there make all the different materials for officer uniforms to inmate uniforms, bedding material, things of that nature. At some point, I believe it was maybe in the late 90s, I don't know that for a fact. I think it was the late 90s or maybe even the early 2000s. There was a significant fire that caused some serious structural damage to that building. And while the prison system officials were trying to figure out what they were going to do with that, bats became habitants of that building. The last estimate that I've heard of the number of bats that are in there, and I'm not sure how they qualify that number, there's 1.2 million bats living in that building. And I think the ongoing question now or concern is the agency, I believe, is trying or deciding that they're going to tear that down. And there's quite some concern from some people in this community, the Huntsville community, that believe it's going to cause an ecological issue because all those bats have to relocate somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the jury is still out on that one, determining what's going to happen. I think there's an effort to buy the building from the prison. Mm-hmm. I think there's an effort to put a new roof on it and maintain that as a habitat for the bats.
Mm-hmm.
And making it a research lab kind of environment for whoever is in that field, I suppose. That's pretty much all I know about the bats.
Yeah. I've always heard stories about them, and I've seen them a couple of times. It's actually pretty interesting.
Yeah. When they come out at night, there's about a 30-minute time frame of just a black or brown ribbon of birds coming out. And
mm-hmm.
They have a certain distinct smell about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It's not necessarily good. But
no, it's not. Not pleasant.
It's notable. Okay. What was the inspiration behind the prison starting the prison rodeo?
That was the vision of our director at the time. That was not the title that he carried at that time, but it was Mr. Lee Simmons. Mm-hmm. Mr. Lee Simmons was his title at that time, was the general manager. Mr. Simmons had a vision of doing something for the inmate population, and that being a kind of a... an event that would give them some recreational opportunities to entertain them and break the monotony of prison life. And also it was a way of him communicating and reaching out to the community and inviting those people in to see an event such as that prison rodeo. It was an overwhelming success, and because of that, he then decided that, you know, there's a way that I can benefit, the prison system can benefit from this by charging admission.
Mm-hmm.
And his focus was that all of that those admissions, a revenue source from that event, would go toward providing educational materials for the inmates. Because at that time there was no any or very little money designated for the purpose of educating the inmate population and rehabilitate them in that effort. Mr. Vision, Mr. Simmons saw the vision that these men needed to be able to do some basic skills of reading and writing and arithmetic. And these funds was a way of him getting that material so that he could then start the education program. So that was his vision. It turned out to be a huge success. We talked about earlier about economical advantage to the citizens here and business people here in Huntsville. That, too, brought a significant amount of gas money, food money, and restaurants and things from all the spectators that came in from various areas. It wasn't uncommon that within a 30-day period, and speaking of four Sundays out of a month, that being the 30-day period, 100,000 people would come watch this event. So it certainly was a major investment for the prison system, but it also reaped a lot of rewards for the prison system.
What year was it discontinued?
When it was discontinued?
Yes, sir.
1986.
I feel like that would have been really interesting to go to.
It was. I worked it several times, and of course, our focus when you work it is not really watching the event as much as you're doing what you're responsible to do, and that is to maintain the security of the inmates and the safety of the public, and making sure that no inappropriate type acts of contraband introduction or things of that nature occurs. And certainly escaped, but there was some very first-class entertainment that came to the rodeo. You know, the judge, when they started out, they were one of the entertainers. George Strait, when he started out, was one of the entertainers. Certainly when Willie Nelson was in his heyday in the 70s, he was a main attraction. And so, you know, the list goes on. They had movie stars come in, Steve McQueen, John Wayne, a lot of people. It was a huge event.
It sounds like it. You had been there, like actually working it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Actually, one of the Sundays I worked is when, trying to remember the gentleman's name, he was a director, Sidney Poitier. He was the director of a movie called Stir Crazy, and that's part of where Stir Crazy was filmed during that rodeo that I worked that particular Sunday.
What was the reasoning for the prison rodeo being discontinued?
Like most good things, politics ruins good things. That's strictly my opinion. I think my statement would be supported by history. But it was, we had some board members at the time that served on the Board of Corrections that were really not into rodeos and things of that nature. By that time, the Windham School District had already been established in the 60s and funding was being provided for the education programs. So that money, although the money from the rodeo still went to education, it was not as a necessity as it was before. I think the main thing, though, honestly, was that we had some board members who just didn't care for it, and they wanted to do away with it, and they made the decision to do so.
And any particular reason? Was it just because of the risk, which is the logical reason, or were
There wasn't. And, you know, people need to. There's a lot of people that think that the rodeo was inhumane, that these inmates were forced to participate, and nothing could be further from the truth. All of the inmates that wanted to participate had to sign up. Mm-hmm. Not only did they have to sign up, they had to compete for the best people that could participate in a particular event, whether it's a bronc riding or the bull riding, whatever it may be. So inmates wanted to participate in the rodeo. They saw a way of getting a thrill out of it, breaking up their monotony, but there was also some cash dividend rewards if they finished in the top of their event. So, were there some risks? Certainly. There were some inmates that were injured. I don't know of any that that died. I'm, I can't think of one off the top of my head where there were any inmates that were killed as a result of participating in the event, but there were some that got some pretty good bumps and bruises. I mean, even your professional rodeo participants today get some serious injuries. But that's just part of the event. But it was an event that the inmates wanted to participate in. It was one that they really, I guess it was a way they could show some of their machoism, you might say. Mm-hmm. And a lot of inmates, if you know an inmate mentality, men in general like to show their machoism sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know,
I can imagine it would be the highlight of their stay. You know, it's pretty much a high point whenever you're literally in prison.
Yes, absolutely.
So did you, I'm assuming that you worked in the prison system for a little while?
Yes, I retired with 30 years with the prison system. I retired as the deputy director, right below the director of the agency. But I was a warden, I was a CO, a ranking officer all the way up to a warden. So I had a good career, I enjoyed it. Got to meet a lot of good people, got to meet some really bad criminals, and I got to see some bad criminals change their life, and that was rewarding in itself.
Okay. So I know that now prisoners can do jobs within the prison that help them develop skills for real jobs in the world whenever they're released. What skill-building jobs do you think are the most beneficial to inmates?
Well, I think on the lines of vocational skills are probably some of the most important ones that we offer. Mm-hmm. Regardless of how technologically advanced we get, there's still going to be a need for plumbers. There's still going to be a need for electricians. There's mm-hmm. still going to be a need for welders in certain areas, even though we now see robots doing a lot of welding and, mm-hmm. and a lot of in our production infrastructures. Mm-hmm. But also, we are also in the age of technology, and we offer a lot of inmates opportunities to participate in data entry, learning how to program. The main thing I think the prison does is teaches a person a work ethic. You know, it doesn't matter how good you are with a skill. If you're lazy and you don't go to work, and you're really not doing anything for yourself or your family, or certainly not the community. Mm-hmm. So I think the prison system foremost is to be able to teach a work ethic and show the importance of that. Because that's where a lot of people get their self-worth is through working. Mm-hmm. People who don't work have a lower self-view of themselves and therefore don't really care. They just kind of in a malaise as they go through life. Mm-hmm. So I think vocational classes that we offer today still are probably some of the primary skill sets that we can offer these men and women. So I think the agency does a good job of doing that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't even count how many times I've gotten my hair cut at that prison.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Historically, if there are any, what do you think are the least beneficial jobs in terms of building skills and whatnot for whenever they're, if they're re-released?
Well, you know, again, I think I have to state that even the dishwashers mm-hmm. in the prison, janitors. I mean, Bucky's paying the janitor $15 an hour now. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, that may still not be enough in some people's view, but who would have thought you'd get paid $15 for sweeping a floor? Mm-hmm. You know, so. I think every job in the prison that I can think of, whether you're a cook, whether you're a dishwasher, whether you are a person who works a washing machine or a dryer, whether you are a sewer on a sewing machine in a garment factory, whether you are making brooms in the broom factory, making furniture in a furniture factory, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. There is something that they can put on their resume and say, I'm not beyond doing this. I think if you did nothing but wash dishes in the prison, when you got out, if you told the employer, listen, I'm not beyond doing whatever measly task you want me to do. The thing is, I have a good work ethic. I'm committed, and I'll do you a good job. I think that's what we need to stress, and I think that's what they do stress in the prison system.
That's true. Okay, so we kind of talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but one of the most interesting moments from the Walls Unit's history that I came across was the hostage crisis of 1974. What could you tell me about that?
Well, what I can tell you is what I have heard from people who were present during that time frame. I was a freshman in high school at that time, but I've read many things about that event. I've read some books that have some good accounts of what occurred. As I said, I've visited with many people that were sergeants and lieutenants at the time. And even shop foremen at the time there when the Carrasco incident occurred. I would say that you used the word interesting. I don't know if that's the proper word. I think it was a tragedy. It's a very sad situation. But basically what you had was you had a person by the name of Fred Carrasco. Fred Carrasco, you could probably use today's terminology that he was a head of a cartel. He basically controlled the heavy heroin and marijuana markets from San Antonio, Bexar County, Texas, down into Mexico. And, and he ruled with an iron fist, like most of the cartel members do. They're pretty brutal in the way that they carry out their organizational decisions. He had, if not himself, he had many people in his organization execute people. There were several law enforcement officers that died at his hands personally or through decisions that he made. And as a result of that, he was a very wanted criminal. And on a particular night, they set up a sting on him, and he was in a gunfight with the San Antonio Police Department, or Bexar County Sheriff's Department, I should say. And he was shot four times, and he survived that event. And as a result of that, once he was incarcerated, he was sent to the Walls Unit, the Huntsville unit, because that had the only hospital at the time. That's where they treated all the inmates in the prison system. And during his healing process, for whatever reason, he ended up being assigned to that unit, which was probably not a very good decision, but it was a decision that was made, purposely or not. But he not only was able to remain at the Walls, he was able to work his way into a job as a clerk for the Catholic chaplain there, Father O'Brien. Because of his organization outside, he was able to mastermind a plan where an inmate, second in command, who would later become an inmate, but it was his second in command, a guy named Benito Alonso, who was head of the Mexican Mafia in Texas for 30 some odd years before he died. He and some of his underlings went and visited with an outside trustee at one of the houses here, and Carrasco visited with him too, and they basically said, listen, we know you're from San Antonio. This is what you're going to do. If you don't do it, we know where your family lives. And what they told him he's going to do is bring some guns into the prison. So that inmate succumbed to the pressure. He allowed a couple gallons of food to spoil, he was bringing that spoiled canned food back to the prison through the back gate, and submerged in a can of ham and also with some peaches. Three pistols were introduced into the prison system along with a bandolera of bullets. And I'm not sure what the day that was when that occurred. I'm not sure I've ever read what date that happened. I'm sure it's somewhere in their investigation when it occurred, when that inmate actually brought those guns in. And I'm not sure how soon from that date to when the actual event occurred, when the Carrasco siege took place. But the Carrasco siege was an 11-day siege. It was the longest-running prison hostage situation at the time. As a result of that, at the end of 11 days, making the story short, we lost two employees. We had two teachers that were executed by Fred Carrasco. He shot Father O'Brien, if I remember correctly, and Rudy Dominguez shot Mrs. Bastetta, and then Mrs. Stanley also was shot and killed. So Miss Stanley and Miss Bastetta died in that event. Father O'Brien survived it. Fred Carrasco said he would never be taken alive. He said so in the negotiation process over that 11-day peace of time. And he did this, that. He committed suicide. He shot himself in the head. Rudy Dominguez was shot by a law enforcement officer and was killed on the spot. And Ignacio Cuevas played dead because of the gruesome sight of all the carnage, you might say. And then once there was enough people there, he opened his eyes and basically said, "I'm still alive." Mm-hmm. He was tried later on, given a sentence of death, and he was executed, I believe it was 17 years later, in the walls, mm-hmm. in the death house, by lethal injection. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much a pretty good summation of the Carrasco incident.
Yeah. It was a wild ride.
Absolutely.
Literally just even reading about it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a book called 11 Days in Hell. It's a very good read. I would recommend it.
Is it about that, I'm guessing?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. What are some of the moments in the prison's history that you have found interesting or tragic or just notable milestones within the history?
Well, I think the most troubling would be the... what the state of Texas did early on in its days of running the prison institutions, and that was where they leased out the prison workforce.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very dark time in our prison history, and the reason it was such a dark time is because inmates were leased out to individuals that ran farming operations or even... some industrial type operations, and although those people, the lessees, were supposed to take care of the nutritional needs, the clothing needs, the medical needs, the spiritual needs of the inmates, they failed miserably. Most of them failed miserably because it cost them money. It's the only reason I can see why they chose not to do it. It was, as sad as I hate to say, it was probably easier to replace an inmate than to expend that money. Mm-hmm. So when an inmate died for whatever reason, whether it was malnutrition or poor medical treatment, whatever it is, they would say, "I'm sorry, Joe Blow died, I need another one." And they would give them another one. So that was a very dark period in our history, one that we never need to repeat, not only in Texas, but anywhere else in the world. Although that does go on, that still goes on in some countries as far as that type of treatment to workers. But certainly in Texas, we never want to repeat that. One of the more, I guess, an ongoing thing that I think is a very positive thing for the state of Texas is the amount of programmatic activities that they have for inmates to participate in,
mm-hmm.
to improve their livelihood. And, you know, the old adage is you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Mm-hmm. The same thing applies to an inmate. You can provide all these programmatic activities, these treatment programs, but unless that person is willing to change, mm-hmm. you're not going to change that person. But the state of Texas does a very good job of presenting and providing and offering those type of programmings. Some of the inmates are required to go through them. Some of them recognize and have an epiphany, I guess you might say, when they're in the middle of it and say, you know, I really do need to change. And then some of them say, just go through the motions because it's required as part of their parole plan or whatever it may be. And those are the ones that, even though on paper it shows they succeeded, they really haven't had a change of heart. And they're the ones that you see coming back through the doors pretty regular.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things I would comment on.
Those are all good, that's for sure. Okay, so the 13th Amendment states, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Because of that distinction, I'm aware that essentially prisoners can be used as free labor. But I also found that from 1866 to 1910, the state legislature enabled the prison superintendent to lease the prisoners for work in the private sector. So you kind of mentioned this a minute ago. I was curious what kind of work that entailed in that time period.
Basically, a lot of it was hard labor.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the men and women that worked in the prison system at that time, most of that labor was doing labor out in the fields, whether it was planting a crop, harvesting a crop, cutting trees and getting more land prepared for additional planting. As well as I said, wood was the biggest fuel source for the prison system. So they're always cutting trees to get their fuel source there. You know, there were very few inmates that worked in the operations of the prison as far as conducting cooking responsibilities, laundry responsibilities, medical responsibilities, things like that. Most every person that was an able body that could work and do hard labor, they were required to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think that was the common work that you saw back during that time period. And, you know, to me, there's nothing wrong with working an inmate that's incarcerated. The good book says if you don't work, you don't eat. You know, and there was a time in TDC where if an inmate didn't work, he didn't eat. He would put on bread and water until he chose to go to work. And that's the quickest way to get to a person's behavior is through his stomach. And I've witnessed that. A guy would get out of 9 meals, he would have 8 meals of bread and a cup of water. And on the 9th meal, he would get a full plate of food. Usually at the end of 15 days, that person was more than willing to go to work and be one of your lead performers. I've had many inmates tell me, you know, when they first went to the hole and was given that type of program of reduced calories, they would throw the food back at the officers. But after about that third day, they were eating the crumbs off their shirts trying to get as much calories as they could. I mean, that's a personal account that inmates have told me. So it was maybe a harsh punishment, but it was one that worked. It was very effective. When the courts basically reduced the ability to work an inmate and the methods in which you get them to work, the prison system lost a lot of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you see that across every prison system in the union.
Mm-hmm. So following 1910, like the reforms that they made in 1910, what kind of work did the prisoners do?
Well, it became became the same type of work. It was just more of a...
not the private sector anymore.
Well, it wasn't the private sector, certainly. But then, you know, when the state, as a taxpayer, let me just say this as a taxpayer, there's no reason for someone that's incarcerated not to work. They need to be able to work to reduce the amount of money it takes to operate the prison, whether that is growing a crop, whether that is sewing boots and for sale on the market or whatever it may be. That's my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I respect everybody's opinion, but more importantly, having been a warden, if you have an idle inmate, you've got a potential problem on your hand.
Mm-hmm.
There was a philosophy that one of our directors had at one time named Dr. Beto, George Beto, who was later, after he retired, became a professor at the Criminal Justice Center at Sam Houston State University. he had a philosophy known as the five absences, or the be those five absences. Mm-hmm. And basically said every prisoner should be absent of five things. And one of them was filth, odor, noise, violence, and idleness. Mm-hmm. Just those five things. And once you understood those principles of eliminating that from being in your prison, you had a well-run institution. No one wants to live in a filthy environment, even inmates. Employees don't want to work in a filthy environment. They don't want to work in an odorous type environment. They don't want to work in a loud environment. Certainly no one wants to be a potential victim of violence. And then idleness is the one thing that creates all of those things. So if you eliminate idleness, you can always clean something. You always make it smell better. You can keep them from making so much noise while they're working. And at the end of the day, from all their work, they're ready to go to bed. Mm-hmm. So it was a very simple philosophy, but one that was very effective, and one that I practiced for years the whole time I was in the prison system.
Okay. That's fair. So the distinction where it was like saying that they couldn't work for the private sector anymore in 1910, what kind of work do they do now? Like, who are they subject to work for? Like, who are they able to be worked for?
Well, there is no, to my knowledge, there are no private companies that are involved in the operations of our industries anymore. At one time that they did, but that was underneath a administration back in the 90s, if I remember correctly. Hmm. But it basically undercut the other businesses that didn't have the cheap labor. Mm-hmm. Okay, which made it very hard for them to compete, whether it was in making windows, whether it was making door jams, whether it was making doors,
just the difference
rebuilding
in cost of labor.
Cars, whatever. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now the private prisons, that's kind of a whole different animal there. Mm-hmm. Okay, the inmates don't work for the private prisons. Mm-hmm. The private prisons work for the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. In reducing their amount of cost in operating. And the private prisons can do that cheaper than the state. But the bottom line is, what do most of the inmates do today? Most of them, they work in those jobs we've already talked about, but is at the pleasure and for the benefit of the state, mm-hmm. not for a capitalist or someone of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So whenever I see an inmate, like, I don't know, fixing up a road or something, are they also able to, like, let's say, work for the city of Huntsville?
Yes.
It's just as long as it's a government entity?
The state prison system can do work for any type of municipality, whether it be a county, whether it be a city, mm-hmm. whether it be another state agency. Many times when I was a warden, I would take inmates out on county roads and clean up the right-of-ways mm-hmm. of the county roads so that it would eliminate the commissioner from having to expend those resources. Here's one thing people don't understand is that when you take a large facility, and I'll use Eastham as an example, which mm-hmm. is in Houston County, that's almost 13,000 acres. Mm-hmm. That is 13,000 of non-taxable land.
Yeah.
So that is one way that the state of Texas can help offer, I guess, a olive branch back to the community, say, you know, we don't pay taxes, but we can offer this type of labor to reduce your tax burden through reducing the amount of resources it takes to maintain something in your county.
Mm-hmm.
And that's done even today here in Huntsville. Many inmates do work for the school here in Huntsville, mm-hmm. whether it be restriping parking lots, whether it be taking the old wax in the hallways of their schools down and re-putting a clear layer of wax on it, mm-hmm. painting the gym, painting the classrooms, you name it, those type of tasks that can be done during the summer months when the students are not there. Mm-hmm. That's a way of reducing the tax burden to that that tax entity.
Oh, yes, sir. Okay, so could you tell me about the history of death row executions in Texas, particularly as they relate to the Walls Unit?
Sure. prior to 1924, each county in the state of Texas, which is 254 counties, if a person was sentenced to death, it was the county's responsibility to carry out that sentence. Mm-hmm. You may have seen some movies in the past or even read that there became a time where if there was a gallows built in a town by the courthouse or wherever, there was a that was a big deal. People would come from near and far to witness this event. And it almost came kind of a carnival type atmosphere at that time. And that didn't speak well to our humanity, at least in the state of Texas it didn't. And the legislature made a decision to say that we're no longer going to do that in Texas. We're going to put the burden of carrying out the sentence of death on the prison system. Mm-hmm. So in 1924, that did become the responsibility of the prison system to carry out the sentence of death. That first method of carrying out the sentence of death was by way of electrocution. Here in this museum, we do have old Sparky, the electric chair that was used. Obviously, because the Huntsville unit was the only unit at that time that had significant structure to it, that is where the electric chair and the sentence of death was carried out, and it still is today. But it's not carried out, obviously, with the electric chair. It's carried out through lethal injection. So I guess by just the fact that Huntsville being the Huntsville unit being the primary center and the first unit to be built, and the logistics of having it in town and things of that nature, that's where they chose to put the task of carrying out that sentence at the Huntsville unit.
I was actually going to ask about Old Sparky. I read that it was made by the inmates.
That's true. Everything I've read, it was designed by, I forget the gentleman's name that designed it, but it was built by inmates from everything I've read.
And it's got to be rough if you're on death row, at least.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Also, something I ran across, it's a random question, but it's related somewhat. Why were the final meal requests discontinued in 2011?
Well, prior to, there was actually a research student out of North Texas State, I believe is where she was from, came down and she was doing a study on how did the last meal become to be an event for someone who was condemned. Mm-hmm. And basically, it goes back to the French from what I've read of her study. I don't know if that's basically what her research said. Now, whether that's totally factual, I don't know. I haven't done the research myself. But to answer your question as to why that they did away with it is because there was a particular inmate in that year that requested a significant amount of food, a certain type of food, and when it came time for them to serve it, he kind of snubbed his nose at it, and it was more of an insult to the prison administration, the taxpayers of the state of Texas, and they said, well, there's no reason, there's nothing says in law that we have to give them a last meal as far as their desires. We do need to give them, offer them a last meal, but there's no reason they can't eat the same food that the general population would be eating that night, whether it be a fried chicken, whether it be a grilled cheese sandwich, whether it be fish, whether it be a pork chop, a hot dog, whatever it is. There's no reason to give any special meals to a person on that sentence for his last meal. Mm-hmm. And because of that person's actions, had he not done that, we may still be doing last meals today. But because he did, it gave such a bad taste in the taxpayers and the people's mouth. They said, we don't need to do that anymore. And they stopped it.
That makes sense. That's unfortunate for everybody else, but it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. With the insanity of our country's politics, how do you see the Huntsville unit changing in the next few decades? Policy-wise or whatever?
You know, I think the biggest effect, obviously, that's been on just not the Texas prison system, but all prisons, federal and state, in our union, has been these activist judges. This could be a very long conversation, but I'll try and make it a summary if I best I can. Most of the judges that are activists view things that, in my observation, are pretty weak-minded on criminal justice issues. Now, I don't want anyone to take what I'm saying that inmates need to abuse or be in an environment where they're abused. That's not what I'm saying. That certainly is not something that needs to be tolerated, should never be tolerated, and should never have existed. But to say that an inmate has to have an air-conditioned cell, I know a lot of people out in our communities that don't have air conditioning. So why does somebody who's committed a heinous crime or even a petty theft, why should they get air conditioning? Now, a lot of the inmates that have health conditions are the ones who are getting that air condition. I can see that to an extent, but all in all, activist judges have ruined a lot of prison systems, strictly my observation. I've seen what the prison system was before the Ruiz case and how it operated. I've seen it and managed it since the Ruiz decision was decided and how it's operated. I think the biggest effect that the courts have had on our prison system has been the downfall of what I call and should be a very safe operations. Our prisons are not as safe as they should be, in my observation. They're not as secure as they need to be, in that inmates are now allowed to basically dress however they want as far as their facial hair, their length of their hair. You know, people say, well, long hair is something they should be able to wear. Well, yeah, they can hide contraband in their hair. I'm just kind of an old school thinker on that. And unfortunately, the courts have just, in my opinion, have made a mockery of our prison system. I think as the future continues, you're going to see it to be hell to pay, unfortunately.
Okay. So with that being said, that's what you kind of see what you think might happen. What would you like to see personally happen to the prison system?
Well, I think one is that if we have any... and this goes with any organization or any business. We can even say within the law enforcement community, that's a huge question. But where my focus is on that thought right now is for those individuals that are in organizations, whether it be a law enforcement community, whether it be the prison system, whether it be a politician, whatever, if they are not a good apple, pluck the apple out of the basket until it contaminates the rest of it. We've seen that with some poor decisions that people have made in the past, and as a result, we want to throw the whole basket out and say, well, it's a bad system. No, we had a bad actor in the system, and we need to address that one actor. On another part, as far as a treatment program thought process would be, that I believe we need to do a better job of changing a people's, changing a person's heart. However that might be done, I have my own personal views on that. I know how I tried to do it. I know how I tried to communicate to people a way of a better lifestyle. But I think if you can change a person's heart and direct that in the direction in a righteous way, at that point, all the education, the vocational skills that two people have, those fruits can then be fruitful. If you don't change a person's heart, you just made a smarter criminal, in my opinion. Okay, so it's very important to me that we're able to touch and turn a dial on that heart and get it in the right direction. How do we do that? That's the million-dollar question. I believe I know what the answer is, and that's what I practice, but to each his own, mm-hmm. you know. But I think a lot of it is changing a person's outlook on life. One, about themselves, about forgiving themselves for what they did. Know that there's a better way to live, and this is what you can do with a better lifestyle. That's where I hope that the prison system is doing in the future, just not in Texas, but in the union.
Understandable. Okay, well, I have run out of questions. Do you have anything that you would like to add?
I would like to say thank you for giving me an opportunity to visit with you today. I certainly want to throw a disclaimer out there. I wouldn't consider myself an expert in any of the fields of the questions you asked. However, what I share with you are my personal experiences being in the prison system as long as I have as an employee and working in the various ranks that I did. But also, I voice some of my personal opinions based on those experiences. And mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that I'm totally right, but I'm pretty close. So I'll leave it at that. And I thank you again for giving me the opportunity to visit with you, and the best of luck to you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you for meeting with me and sharing your thoughts and knowledge and opinions. I'm sure that everything will be helpful in the research that I'm doing so far. If you have any additional thoughts to add or concerns, you can go ahead and reach out to me. But if we have nothing else, we can go ahead and conclude the interview.
That sounds good. Thank you.
All right.